Hi, everybody. I'm Sandy Griffin, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 1st, 1989, and it's through people like you and a sponsor who loved me enough until I could learn to love you and got my understanding. I will tell you, before I came here, I really had this big bouffant hairdo before I got here, so I just want to let you know. That's my first line. Okay. But I want to thank Paige and Mary for inviting me. It's always an honor, and I say that with all my heart. I feel that from the bottom of my heart. It's always an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I love God, and I love the fellowship. You know, all my life, I have to tell you, that's all I really wanted was to love and be loved. And it's what I did to get that. That's why I've got a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank my road dog, Belinda, for for riding up with me. And so, but thank you all for being here. I know it's hot. My job up here, I love the name of this group, Came to Believe, because really that's my job up here, is to tell you how I got that relationship with the God of my understanding, with God, who actually got me here. I mean, truly, when you hear my story, there was no family, well, a little bit, we'll get into that. DUIs, nothing like that. It was truly God touched me. So that's my story. But that's what I'm supposed to do up here, is tell you how I got this relationship with God who got me here. I'm going to start from the very beginning. I love it. It's my story. I was born in 1951 to a nice Jewish family. I was the youngest of six, and the only thing I can remember when I was growing up was fear. I don't know where that fear came from, but fear ruled my life. I saw all my sisters and brothers, and, you know, it goes like this. This is this year. It's 70, 71, 72, 73, 78, 79. My mom was a busy woman. We're Jewish. We're not Catholic. I don't know how that happened, but that's... So I grew up with all these sisters and brothers, and they all looked like they had it. I don't know what it was, but they had it. And I wanted it. And I know with all that fear that I had as a kid, you know, I was always looking over my shoulder. I was just afraid. And but my sisters and brothers, you know, they were all straight-A students. They all were ambitious. You know, even today, all my brothers and sisters are all doctors and lawyers. I was so grateful to graduate high school. I barely made it out of there. I mean, I just was that type of person that I just wanted to have fun. All I could focus on was me, not me tomorrow, not me yesterday. I just wanted to focus on what I'm doing today. And so at the age of 15, I took my first drink. Now, in the Jewish religion, people drink this thing called Manischewitz wine all the time. And they do it on the high holidays. And I found myself, that's what I was doing. No one in my family's alcoholic, by the way, because we're all told Jews are not alcoholics. So everybody would leave the table and I would just start packing that Manischewitz wine. It went down really easy, but it didn't come up really well. It's not good stuff. So I drank at the age of 15 for the first time, and I'll tell you, I drank alcoholically from the very first. When that alcohol went into me, and I hear it all the time, something happened to me. It was like a light switch, you know, and all of a sudden, that fear melted away. I could look you in the eye. I could talk to you. I wasn't afraid anymore. And so why wouldn't I keep doing that? But since I didn't see anybody else drinking that way in my family or my friends, because I only hung out with Jews because that's what we did, but I didn't see anybody else drinking, and so I was a shameful, sneaky drunk. I would go, and whenever I go out with my friends, if we did go out drinking, I would drink before I went out with them just to be okay with them. And then when I left them, I could finish the job. But I was a sneak and I was shameful. And that was all through me. So I was not the type of alcoholic like, oh yeah, I drink, I lied from the very beginning, just right from the get-go. So I graduate high school. Don't know how. I'm from Norfolk. I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia. So I moved to Washington, D.C., and it's like I had arrived. Oh, my gosh. I was on my own, and I was just doing whatever I wanted to do. I started working up at the hospital, and I started getting in trouble at work because of alcohol. I didn't know it then, but, you know, I would go to work, and my boss would say, why weren't you here? You know, you're supposed to be here. You know, I would show up to work, you know, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and I'd be gone on Friday because that started my weekend. And then it turned over to I was gone Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And he just kept saying, you're supposed to be here. But a true alcoholic keen mind, I said, yeah, but when I'm here, I'm good. You know, because I always had an answer. So I started getting in trouble at work. So everybody in my family got married at the age of 21 because back then you were considered an old maid if you weren't married. So at the age of 23, since I was getting in a lot of trouble, I thought, you know, that's what I need to do is get married. You know, so at the age of 23, I picked out this perfect specimen. I picked out a nice Jewish doctor. And everybody was going to be so happy. Number one, my family was like, oh my God, she's going to marry a doctor. It's going to be wonderful. You know, she's going to finally settle down. Two, he could write prescriptions. Three, he would be married to his profession and I could still do whatever I wanted to do. So it's like I won the trifecta, you know?
Right.
So on November 9th of 1974, that morning that I was getting married, I called my girlfriend up and I said, oh, I'm thirsty. I don't know why I'm thirsty, but I was thirsty. So I said, let's just go have a drink. So I went out that morning and I drank a bottle of vodka and I took four Quaaludes. I would have married anybody that was beside me. I mean, I was just right. You know what you mean when you're just right. So by the time the nightfall came, I got married and I was only married for 3 weeks. But I have a good reason. Because I'm quick. I saw another guy go by that I wanted. You know, I was like that. I was so inconsiderate and thoughtless. And so that's what I did. I just got bored and I want you instead. And so what I did is I went to my family who I needed their approval so bad with everything that I did. But I went to them and I lied about him. I told these horrible stories and they were glad I got rid of him. And none of it was true. That's the kind of person that I was. I mean, this was just not a one-time deal. That's the kind of person I was. If what I wanted, I want what I want and I was gonna get what I wanted no matter what. So that was in 1974. I didn't get sober until 89. I have a lot of stories like that. I don't have too much glamour stories. You know, I just have stories like that. So I'm living up in D.C., you know, and that guy that I left him for lasted 3 months because that's a long-term relationship for me. I mean, I either got bored or, you know, I wanted to be loved so bad, so whoever gave it to me, it was, you know, it was free. You know, I'm going there. So, I'm living up in D.C., and I get sick. I'm working up at NIH at this time, and I get sick with this thing called multiple sclerosis. And they put me on disability because I was in a wheelchair, and I had lost my eyesight for like a year, and I got it back and everything, but the reason I tell you all that is because this is what I did. I turned to alcohol for my solution. You know, alcohol was working for me. And alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was my solution. So what I did is I put on disability. At that point, I was never at that point ever self-supporting through my own contributions. So I get out of the wheelchair, and this is where I start doing my geographics. People call them geographical cures. I call them geographical survival instincts because I would started moving from city to city. I lived everywhere. I mean, I lived in New York, I lived in Tennessee, I lived in Florida, I lived in Philadelphia. The reason I had to move so much is because of the type of alcoholic that I was. I would come live with you and just stir up trouble. I was such a troublemaker. I'd end up either sleeping with your husband or all your friends or stealing everything that I could because I had this other disease and it was called stealing. If it wasn't nailed down, it was mine, you know? And I don't even know where that came from. So I kept moving. I'm a ducker and a hider. I'm a runner. I don't like confrontation. So I'm really good at leaving in the middle of the night. As soon as I know that I'm going to get in a little trouble, I'm gone. I'm gone. So I was living in Tennessee at this time, Jackson, Tennessee, and I was living with other people who were just like me. We were getting in trouble with the law. We would get in trouble at, he would get arrested, him and his wife all the time for drunken in public and making a nuisance. And so I was getting in a lot of trouble there, but my mom called up and said my dad got sick. My dad got sick from this thing called mesothelioma, and he was only 60 years old. And so they were sending him from Norfolk to MD Anderson in Texas for this protocol they had that for, and it was like 30, 40 years ago. So my mom went down there, and my dad, who I love with all my heart and soul, and she gets down there and she needed some help. She really needed a break, and she wanted to go back to Norfolk, take a break. And she wanted one of her kids, she had six kids, you know, one of us to come and help her. And so I was the only one not working. I'm the only one not married. I'm the only one who doesn't have children. All them are they're professionals, you know, they're living a life. So I volunteered to go down to MD Anderson to help my dad, because I love him. I love my dad. And I go down there. And because I want to be that good daughter. I really want to be a good sister. I really want to be a good human being. I just didn't have the skills. So I go down there, and my mom leaves, and I look at my dad, and I got thirsty. I don't know why I got thirsty. I didn't know I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't know those things whatsoever. So I look at my dad, and I said, I'll be right back. And I go out to have that one drink. That one drink I see other people taking with impunity, because I needed that ease and comfort. I really needed it. And so I go out and I don't go back for 5 days. And I get back to my dad's room and I'm feeling that remorse, that guilt, and that shame, that spree they talk about in the big book. I just came to that. And I go back to the room and my dad gives me that look like, where have you been? What are you doing? You're supposed to be here helping me. You know, and I don't know what to do with that stuff. I can't handle anything. So I know what to do. I went back out to have that one more drink. And I come back 2 days later. And the nurse pulls me over and she said, Sammy, we've got to call your family because your dad's dying. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. My family can't see the condition I'm in. How selfish and self-centered could I have been? You know, I wasn't even thinking about him. All I could do was think about me. And I left. I left my dad in the middle of the night, and he died. I didn't even get to say goodbye to my dad. You know, that's alcoholism. Alcohol was making all my decisions for me. I couldn't do it. I had to have that drink. That drink was now in control. So my dad dies, and I go back to Norfolk, you know, for the funeral. And how do I show up to the funeral? I show up drunk. And my sisters and brothers, my sister pulls me over, and she spits on me. And she goes, we don't want you here. You know, and I've got this alcoholic attitude, you know, like I can do whatever I want to do. I can stay, you know. I had long hair, and I probably flipped it, to tell you the truth. And so I stayed, you know, I stayed. And after, and this is the part that I've come to realize recently. My mom just lost her husband. And I just lost my husband. you know, and the pain that my mom must have been in. She was 60 years old, and she just lost her best friend. And here I'm there. I'm out every single night. I'm not there for her. And she had to worry about whether I'm dead or alive, if I'm ever going to come home, and she's grieving. You know, and I know that feeling now. And when I think about it, because the pain of losing my husband has been devastating, and to think that she was in that same stuff, and I was just gone. And what did I do to my mom? I left her too. I end up leaving, and I go down to Florida. And now I have to tell you, in between all these times, I did go back to my mom a lot, because I knew my mom would always accept me back, because I was kicked out of a lot of people's homes. I was left a lot, and because of my behavior, you know, it was my behavior that got me there. And so I'd end up there all the time. But I ended up in, I was in some kind of state of mind. I don't know what I was in. But my mom needed me to come home to help her out. So I go back to Norfolk to help her out. That's what was my plan. So I leave Florida in the middle of the night. And I was supposed to go to Norfolk, but I ended up in Richmond, Virginia. That's how I got there. Now, in between all this time, and no offense to you men, but men really weren't that important in my life. I was engaged a lot of times out there. You know, I had a lot of fun. But men were just like a dime a dozen to me. I know that sounds pretty harsh, but that's what they were to me. I mean, if I wanted one, I'd get one. I mean, okay. But, you know, I was a mover and a groover, and I just would leave you in the middle of the night. That's how I was. So, and I don't even remember their names. But there was a few. So I'm coming back to Norfolk, and I left my sister. She wanted me to help her out, and I couldn't do it, you know, because I kept getting thirsty all the time. I wouldn't show up. And I was still drinking in bars at that time, because by the time I came to you, I had learned to drink alone. But I ended up in Richmond, Virginia, and I had one sister left that I haven't gone to and used, because she was one that just scared me to death. She always scared me ever since I was a little girl. She was a redhead, and she was a true redhead. She scared me. And so I end up, she owned this beautiful restaurant. It was fine dining. It was really nice. And I became a bartender there. And what was so good about me becoming a bartender is that it was a perfect job for me. You know, one for you, two for me. I didn't believe in ice. I didn't believe in umbrellas. Hell, just take the cap off. You know, that's how I was the kind of, bartender that wanted to teach. I wanted to teach everybody about every kind of liquor there was. You know, let's try this one, you know. So my sister would come to me. She goes, Sammy, you're getting everybody drunk. And I'm like, of course. You know, that's what I do. But this is the sad part. I started having blackouts. Now, I had blackouts. My first blackout is when I was 24 years old. And I had my 12-year-old niece with me. I was in Connecticut. I just don't even know, remember why I was in Connecticut. And my 12-year-old niece was with me, and I took her bar hopping. Do you remember those things where you go to one bar and you had like 12 to go to and you check off the list? My first blackout was I started at one bar, and came to at the last bar, you know, and I was like, whoa, you know, what do you do with blackouts? You know what I do with them? I throw them away in my mind, like I do people, bills, anything I can, I throw away because I don't want to look at it. So I'm at this bartending, and I'm going into blackouts now, not just for one day, but for weeks at a time. And I would be, a funny story, I would be bartending and someone would just start yelling at me, and I was just coming out of a blackout, and I'm going, look, I just got here myself, you know, let me know what's going on. But my sister and I, things clashed, and we ended up losing that restaurant. I will say I did most of it because I was doing a lot of illegal things there. So that's this is the time. It was in the 80s. I don't know, early 80s. I don't really remember exactly the dates of anything. But it was the last time that I was going to be able to see my family again. But I didn't know that then. I started working at this other bar. And when I was there, I got a typed letter from my family. Typed. And in that letter, they said, in the Jewish religion, what they do is they take their sleeve and they rip it and they killed me off. I was now no longer a member of my family. And it killed me. It killed my heart. Everything that was good and clean and decent in my life was gone. I was really living, one might say, to drink. That's all I was doing. I don't think I drew a sober breath for a long time. And so what I did with that letter is I did with everything else. I just threw it away. But it killed my heart. It killed me. And so someone had been stealing from my boss, and he didn't tell me that he put up these cameras. So I come into work one day, you know, and it actually at night, because I couldn't work during the day because all of a sudden I became allergic to the sun. You know, when you drink like I drink, I couldn't stand the sunlight. So I would work at night. So, and I would even use that word loosely, working. But I show up to work on a Friday night, and my boss calls me into his office, and he has this VCR player. Guys, it was in the 80s. If you're young here, it was a big thing with a big tape around that big. And so he put the VCR tape in the recorder, and he catches me stealing on tape, and I denied it was me. I was truly at the park, just like the big book says. I couldn't differentiate between the truth and the false. What I had become is I had lied so much that my lies became my truth. I believed everything that I said. I could have taken a lie detector test and passed. So, he doesn't fire me. I mean, he fires me, but he doesn't call the police. He doesn't do anything. He just fired me, and he looked right at me and goes, Sammy, you need help. You're really sick. And this is the condition that I was in at this time, because this was at my bottom. I wore this Ritz sweater always. I mean, I had stopped bathing because bathing had gotten really hard. It was too hard to get up and bathe. And I wore a headband for 30 or 40 years. I don't know. I wore a headband because I was a hippie. I was a flower child. I had flowers in my hair. They were dead, but they were still in my hair. And I didn't ever change that. And I wore the same outfit forever, you know. And so that's funny, me denying that picture of me, you know. But also, when he fired me, I got into my car that was in the same condition I was in. It was trash. My car had never seen oil, ever. You know, it had retread tires. Remember the ones you see floating in the back of your rearview mirror, rubber flying off? I'm really good. I've got skills because I can change tires really well. And so I go back to my apartment, which was trashed, just like I was. I was still very shameful, and so I never threw anything away. I had bottles. If I did, it would be in the middle of the night to take them somewhere. I guess I didn't want anybody to know how I drank. I just was so shameful about it. So I go back to this apartment that, you remember, I'm not paying for, because, you know, I'm on disability from the government. They're paying for it. And I still don't have a penny to my name. And I go back to this apartment and I don't drink. You know, I just fell asleep. And that morning when I came to, something happened to me. And it's the same thing that something happened to me when I took that first drink. It's no wonder why we call our drinks spirits, because that spirit came into me. Now, I've got to tell you, I didn't know what happened to me. I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was different. And I picked up my phone, which was not really mine. I had spliced it with my neighbor's, because I have skills. And called up my best friend's sister, whose daughter had gotten help somewhere. So it's just amazing how we connect the dots, how it all connects. And I called her and she goes, Sammy, don't move, I'm coming to get you. And I said, okay. I don't even know what I'll say an okay to. A woman or nobody had been in my apartment for years. For years. So I let this woman in my apartment and she goes, Sammy, I'm going to take you to treatment. And I said, okay. And I have no idea what treatment was. So I get in the car and we go to, in Richmond, there's a place called Tucker's. It's at Chippenham Hospital. And it's a treatment center. And this is in the 80s. So it was a treatment center for 30 days, 28 days. And I go up to treatment and I'm the only one around out of 30 people. I was so happy to be there. I was one of those people that you would have hated. It wasn't about the alcohol for me anymore. I was at the end of me. I didn't want to be me anymore. I was so sick of Sammy. I was sick of me. I just didn't want anything. They told me in treatment, they said, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I'm like, throw the whole thing away. Because in the big book, it says this. I wanted to be recreated. And that's a lot for a Jew to say. I mean it. I wanted that recreation. I did. And so from day one, I was thirsty for the knowledge. I was thirsty for changing. I was thirsty, and I didn't know that I was thirsty for God. I had no idea. So up in treatment, they told me that I was an alcoholic, and of course, I was one of those who did not know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know. I just thought I was mentally ill. You know, the big book says that to some of us, it's a, you know, to the extreme, we're so mentally ill. And I was. I couldn't read. I had lost all my reading skills. They like evaporated. I couldn't really do much of anything. And they explained to me, they really did tell me a lot up there. They told me these six words that I think are the meat and potatoes of Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to trust God, clean house, and help others. Those six words have stayed with me till today. So they told me up there, they said, you know, Sammy, I want you to look to your left and I want you to look to your right because only one of y'all are going to make it. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I feel so sorry for you because I was never a good Jew, but all of a sudden I'm the chosen one, you know. I knew that I was going to be the one. And so they told me that I had to get a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was. And they said they gave me 7 days to get one. So, you know, the meetings were brought into the hospital. And so on the seventh day, I ran up to this woman and I said, would you be my sponsor? And then I ran away because I was obviously afraid of rejection. I don't know. I was fearful of everything. And so she comes up to me and she hands me this piece of paper and she looks me right in the eye and she goes, I want you to use this. It's like she handed me the keys to the kingdom. You know, I felt it to my bone. I felt that someone cared about me for the first time in a long, long time. And that woman today is still my sponsor. I've kept her sober for over 31 years. And if you're a sponsor, you know what I mean. You know, so, and I love her dearly. You know, there's a lot of times I wanted to get rid of her because I thought I outgrew her or I needed a guru sponsor, you know, and I just thought I needed more. This woman has given me everything. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything. I grew up here. You know, I was 38 years old when I got sober and I literally was like a baby. I was like taking baby steps and I had to grow up because I was an extremely emotional, immature brat. I guess, you know, that's what my sponsor called me, so I guess I was a brat. So that started my journey. When I got out of treatment, my sponsor opened up her house to me, and I got to live with her for that first year. And I want to tell y'all how great I think that is, because I am not really a leader. I'm a follower, and if I hang around with certain people, I will follow them. And I'm not saying that to put myself down at all. I'm saying I just know myself. I just know if I hang around with you people, if I hang around with y'all and stay in the middle of the pack, then I'm going to get what y'all got. I knew that instinctively. I don't know how I knew that. So my, I started living with her and I couldn't read. So my sponsor sat me down and Mary, we're talking about it, how you were just going through the book. And my sponsor sat me down and we read the big book line by line, paragraph by paragraph. It said to pray, we prayed. If it said write, we wrote. And I used the word we because we did it together. If you're new, you never have to do this alone. You never have to be alone ever again. And here's the good news and the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous. You never have to drink again. I never have to pick up a drink because of the people that I met and the God of my understanding. And the way I got to that God was my sponsor. I can't be more grateful today. I'm so grateful that I got her as a sponsor because she knew exactly what I needed and what we all need. She sat me down and everything was way over my head. I didn't even understand the word powerlessness. I truly did not. I felt very inadequate about the steps. I felt like I couldn't do them right. But the biggest thing that she gave me was step two. And that's why I love the name of this meeting, Came to Believe. Because my sponsor told me, she goes, Sammy, you're going to start talking to God. Because I didn't have one at all, neither good nor bad. I want you to start talking to God. And I want you to go in your room and talk to Him like we're talking. And I thought to myself, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. You know, but I did it. But I did it. You know, I saw people in these rooms and I could see in their eyes that they had it. Remember, I always wanted it. I don't know what it was, but I saw they had it. You know, and I wanted it. So I would go up to everybody. How do you pray? How do you do it? How do you get it from here to here? How is that journey? How does that happen? And my sponsor would say, I want you to practice because that's the key. The key is I want you to practice anything you practice. You know, I can't read enough about it. You know, if you want to learn how to type, you're not going to read a book about it. You're going to go do it. You've got to just put it into action. And so I came in, and this is the miracle for me. I was not a kind person. I used people. I was a manipulator, a liar, a cheat, you know, a thief. I didn't seem to have any caring feelings. And I say that with all my heart. I didn't know what it was like to care about somebody. So that is why, for me, the steps were the most spiritual thing that I could have done. Because what that did for me is it got me out of me. I had to see the truth about Sammy. And I didn't like it. I don't, you know, you hear people say, oh, the fourth step, I was enlightened. You know, what a wonderful feeling. I hated it. I hated knowing the truth about me. I didn't like to know that I was the most selfish person or so dishonest. It didn't, you know, I protected all that for years and years. Everything that I did that was wrong or, you know, inconsiderate and thoughtless and mindless, what I did with those things is I stuffed them down inside me. All those years, it was like building a brick wall. And see, what the fourth step and fifth step did for me, it unleashed that. Chuck Chamberlain, uncover, discover, and discard. And that's what happened with me. My sponsor, I had a problem with my family. My family disowned me. And so it had been at least 5 years since my family talked to me. And I cried. I cried all the time. Your family loved you. How come my family? You know, I've been doing prison work for 29 years, and I'd go to prison, and a woman had killed her father, and they were still coming to see her. You know, I didn't kill anybody, I don't think. And, but I couldn't understand it. Your family loved you and stuck behind you, and I just felt so bad about it. So when it came to the ninth step, oh my God, it was like a Judas step for me. I really, you know, my sponsor said, you're going to make amends to your family. I'm like, you know, thinking to myself, you want me to make amends? You make amends to them. They hate me. I hate them. Isn't that how it goes? So the ninth step is a real big step for me. My sponsor believed in making amends financially. I had to, I couldn't belong to a bank because I was a code 6 because, you know, they don't like forgery for some reason. And so I had to have money order. So the guy that I stole from, I started paying him back in money orders immediately. As soon as I got a J-O-B, my sponsor made me get a job. You know, and it didn't matter. She goes, I said, yeah, but, you know, it's going to be a, what kind of job can I get? And she goes, I don't care if you get a terrible job. You're just getting a job. You know, so I sold pretzels at a mall, so hot dogs. You know, and I'm Jewish. We don't do things like that, you know. But I did it, you know. And there's a moral to that story. But I started having to make all these amends, and I made it to the guy that I stole from. And after 2 years, he called me up and he said, Sammy, you don't owe me any more money, and would you come work for me again? And so I went to work for him as a dishwasher. And 11 years later, I owned that restaurant. That is coming full circle. And I didn't make amends knowing that I was going to get this. I promise you that, because I'm not an ambitious person. And I'm just kind of glad I'm not, because I just do what's in front of me. You know, I'm not a searcher for that. And they say great events will come to pass, you know? They say that. And so that's... So I was making amends, and I wrote my mom and my sisters and brothers, and did I get anything in return? Nothing. And it killed me all over again. And so after a couple of years, my mom finally wrote me back, and she was willing to meet with me. So my first car was a Volare. I don't know if y'all remember those cars, but it didn't have a grill. It cost me $200. And I was a real AA groupie. I had stickers all over it. And so I went to my sponsor. I said, June, I've got to, you know, borrow someone's Mercedes to go meet my mom. And she goes, no, you'll just drive what you got. And I said, you don't understand. My mom's going to probably expect me to drive up in a Mercedes. And she goes, well, that's just so sweet. You're driving what you got. And so you know who won. So I go and I meet my mom. And nothing really happened. There was nothing big deal about the Volare, but there's a moral to that story. So I go meet my mom, and I get my relationship back with my mom. And so then now it's the rest of the family. My dad had passed, but my mom, my sponsor didn't care really that much about my sisters and brothers. I'd written them, made my amends. It's, you know, damn over the water. I'm not going to pay the electric bill again. So, but I'm still pretty upset about family stuff. So my oldest brother calls me, and it's 11 years later, and he said, Sammy, it's about time we meet. And I said, okay. It had been 16 years since I had seen him. And I said, okay. And that was shocking to me. And I, you know, if it had been years later, I would have said, now where were you when I really needed you? You know, it's always in your court. And I remembered, this what came to me. It wasn't in his court, it's not even mine. It was in God's time. God had to heal my heart. And my heart was healed. You know, because of all the work that we do in here, all the stuff that we do, you know, making coffee, giving rides, sponsoring people, you know, what we do in here changes you. There's a change that comes over us. You know, and it's all of a sudden my heart enlarged. You know, I don't have that hardness around it anymore. You know, in the St. Francis prayer, this is such a good example for me. In the St. Francis prayer, it says, I want to love than to be loved, to comfort than to be comforted. You know, to comfort, rather to be comforted. And I wanted to live on that right side of that prayer. I had been that left side all my life. I was hateful, you know, and so, you know, that's all I wanted to do, is just to be a kind person, have compassion, and that's what you people have taught me. And it's not one of those things that came easy for me. I'd be at a meeting and I'm like saying to my sponsor, I hate that woman. Ugh. You know, and she goes, why don't you go hold hands with her after the Lord's Prayer? I'm like, well, are you kidding me? You know, the things that my sponsor and you people have taught me has enlarged my heart. So my mom had a birthday party. She turned 90 years old. And my oldest brother invited me to that. I hadn't seen my family now in 25 years. I was 18 years sober. And I was scared. It scared me. I said, yes, I will be there. And I go some of y'all may know Jack Quarterman. He's passed now. But Jack Quarterman, I was speaking with him. And I went up to him. I said, you know, I've got some fear about this. And he said, Sammy, all you have to do is suit up and show up. God's already led the way for you. And he was right. I went down to Florida and I took you with me. I took my husband and I took God. And I walked in there and I had my head up because I didn't have to crawl before anyone. I'm a child of God. And I walked in there and it's been 25 years. I had nieces and nephews I've never met. There was over hundreds of people there. Did they talk to me? Not at all. They didn't talk to me. But I knew that I was there for my mom, you know? And they could see, you can see that I'm a sober woman of Alcoholics Anonymous. They could see that. And when I left there for the first time, because of the actions that I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous and that I take today, that for the first time I felt like I was enough. I felt like what I have is enough. That car I drove that she made me drive, that was enough. Who I am, exactly who I am, the most authentic person that I can be, is enough. I'm not a perfect person. I want a perfect daughter. I want a perfect sister. You know, I'm not a, you know, I wasn't perfect back then. But I have grasped and developed a manner of living, you know, that has changed my life, that I can be today. A good friend, you know, a good sister. You know, my oldest brother and I are talking today. I can be that today. How does that happen to someone like me that didn't have any skills whatsoever to ever being that person? I want to end with this story because this is how my husband ended his story. So I wanted to bring him into it. There was a guy named Saul in the Bible. And Saul was a bad guy. I mean, tax collector, beat people, stone people. He was just a bad guy. And on his way to Damascus, God intervened and knocked him off his horse. In fact, he went blind. But he changed him in from Saul to Paul. And God loved Paul. And Paul loved God so much. And Paul had this problem. Paul had a thorn in his side. The Bible doesn't even say what that thorn is. But he asked God three times, not once, because he knew God loved him so much. He said to God, God, please remove my thorn. And God said each time, my grace is sufficient to pull you through. I may be an alcoholic, but God's grace has been sufficient to pull me through. Thank y'all so much.